Mr. Speaker.
If not,
Mr. Speaker.
The chair will put them in rows.
Mr. Speaker.
The bill is passed.
We've created a commitment to America.
Those in favor say aye.
The House passed a foreign aid package. Now what? Hello and welcome back to Control, a podcast where we look around the corner at the challenges and priorities facing Congress. I'm one of your hosts, Annalise Keller.
And I'm your other host, Brendan Buck. Welcome back to the podcast. I won't call this an emergency pod, but this is an unscheduled pod. The House is not in session, so usually we would be off. But a few things happened over the weekend, so we thought it would be good to get back together and do a little recap, as this was, I think, a bit of a crescendo for the House for the year. So since our last episode, the House did pass that foreign aid package, and we'll talk about the vote count, how that went down, and all of the challenges with the Rules Committee that actually got us there. Obviously, we will talk a lot about Speaker Johnson's leadership and where he stands, in particular Marjorie Taylor Greene and her motion to vacate, what her options are, the choices that she will make. And then Annalise is insistent that we do an update on the Mayorkas impeachment trial, which, as we all know, went nowhere.
Yeah, got to give the people what they want. Close it out. Well, let's go back to Johnson first. I mean, I was really, really impressed with how he navigated these challenges. Like, we'll talk about it. It wasn't easy. I think I want to say it was April 17th when he was doing like a little gaggle. I think it ran on C-SPAN, but he just kind of lays out exactly what he's going to do, how he's going to let the, you know, chips fall as they may. Let's listen to that.
My philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. Look, history judges us for what we do. This is a critical time right now, a critical time on the world stage. I could make a selfish decision and do something that that's different, but I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing.
I think that was just a remarkable, act of courage and bravery on his part to, you know, he doesn't really have a lot of options here. And I think we've been talking about how that is his best path forward, right? To just kind of get this Ukraine package done, do what he thinks is right, and then to just sort of let things happen. And I think obviously on Saturday, that's what he did. Now, there's still a lot to figure out about where we go from here, but I just think it is worth spending some time commending him on that.
I mean, we can pat him on the back. I think we should first, though, pat ourselves on the back. I want to take a bit of a victory lap. Listeners of this podcast know that we have been the most optimistic people in Washington about the potential for this to still get done. Every week we would say, still feels like it's going to get done.
Vibes.
And purely off of vibe. Not purely off of vibes. I mean, it just, I guess I will confess, last week we were a little worried that he was going to go squirrely on this, but it just felt all along that you have that many people who want to do something that important and that urgent. You can't just ignore it forever. And there were a lot of people around here, the punch bowls of the world, who at one point said that this was dead. Eventually I think the right side sort of prevailed here. Yeah. Courageous is a word that has been thrown around a lot. Different definitions of that, but it was certainly not an easy thing for him to do. I think as we discussed last week, it would have been much easier for him to come up with some excuse why they're not ready or they need to do some other thing on border or whatever it was and try to preserve himself. And this was definitely not an act of self-preservation. I think he will survive this, at least in the short term. But for his own long-term politics, it was probably really damaging. It'll be really hard for him to remain in the top of leadership next Congress, and we'll get into all of that. But I thought it was really great. His comment that, you know, you do the right things sounded a lot like one of my former bosses, John Boehner, that used to say all the time, if you do the right things for the right reasons, the right things will happen. So it seems like he got a sort of new perspective on his colleagues, new perspective on what's important when he actually took over as speaker. And that tends to happen. When the weight of a situation is actually on your shoulders, you look at things a little differently.
Yeah. I think the sense from talking to people around town is that he was, you know, really leaning on, some of his advisors and talking, getting some good advice and sort of drowning out the noise and just kind of going forward with his plan and not straying from that path, which I think is challenging when an environment like this is just so remarkably noisy.
Yeah, noisy. And I think they probably had to know that they were going to lose a lot of their members on this. And I wonder what the conversation was among the leadership team about going forward with something like this. To date, Johnson has seemed to sort of operate on his own and doesn't really keep close counsel with his rest of his leadership. I guess Steve Scalise being back, I'm sure that they're in regular contact. But this did feel like Johnson making a play call, like in a way that, you know, the leadership team probably understood the risks, but he said, I'm just going for it. And he even had Elise Stefanik, one of his own leadership members, voting against him on Ukraine. So not an easy thing to do. And I was a little worried last week when he kind of walked in on Monday and said, we're making a play call, and then spent the rest of the week sort of talking to the conservatives, trying to see if there's some other way. And it felt like, oh, God, is he going to walk again? But he didn't move forward. Some ugly votes for sure, and we should talk about that. But to credit to him, this is probably the most important thing that he will do this Congress, and he got it done.
Yeah, let's get into that. The other thing that we've talked about is, that I think did sort of play out is how Johnson could bring up a foreign aid package that sort of stays close to the Senate package, but puts in a few things for Republicans, sort of some sweeteners. That's kind of what he did here. He sort of had that $9 billion in economic aid to Ukraine structured as a loan. There are a few other things. We'll get into the immigration element of it all, I'm sure, after. But let's talk a little bit about how foreign aid came together. So, there are three different votes. The largest piece, $60 billion for Ukraine, passed 311 to 112. Notably, 112 Republicans voted against it. They didn't lose any Democrats. And then there's, of course, the $26 billion package for aid to Israel, which passed by a wider margin for Republicans, 366 to 58. And then they separated out the third piece of the supplemental, the $8 billion to Taiwan and other Indo-Pacific allies, and that received even more support, 385 to 34.
So other than Israel, of the two of those three things, you had more Democrats voting for them than Republicans. And I think that ultimately is what is going to be the big problem for Johnson. I mean, he obviously lost a majority of the majority on Ukraine, but this is just what feeds into Marjorie Taylor Greene's criticism that they have sort of given the floor to Democrats. It's not so much that it's even bipartisan, it's just that the other party is voting for it more.
Well, they've created this dynamic where everything has to move through suspensions, thus removing Speaker Johnson of any leverage.
Yeah, and so to me, the votes on the substance are a little less interesting than the vote on the process. So this bill and the various components of it were brought up under a rule that Democrats overwhelmingly carried. That is in itself extraordinarily rare. It is rare for the minority to vote for a rule at all. It happens from time to time. I think it happened on the debt limit agreement. But you had significant number of Republicans voting against their party's rule. And you would probably find single-digit examples of this. I think the last time the minority voted for a rule more than the majority did was in 2009, actually. It was a border supplemental for Trump that he was insisting on. The Senate passed and Pelosi brought up, and Democrats were not excited about it. And so that was the last time that a Republican or a minority voted for the rule more than the majority, but it's exceptionally rare. And that, but to your point, like, the conservatives who are complaining the most about it are the ones who created this situation. They have completely written themselves out of the process when they know that they are insisting on things that simply cannot happen. Big fight over wanting to add immigration policy to this. That was just never going to happen. And so this is what you have to do. I mean, things have to get done. If you're not going to be a constructive part of the process, you're going to get cut out and you're going to end up having, you know, a policy you don't like. When you don't play, people who, you know, are the adults in the room are going to just leave you behind.
Yeah. So in the end, I mean, they stayed, you know, in terms of the content of the policy.
This is the Senate
bill. Yeah. I mean, there's some different procedures that were used to get here, but this is going to get sort of Frankensteined together and it's going to, you know, probably pass the Senate. I don't imagine they'll keep the Senate here much later than Wednesday of this week. So I would expect it to pass the Senate.
It's the Senate, I mean, with the, you know, with the add-ons, you know, that were supposed to make Republicans feel better, but I don't know that they actually made Republicans feel any better. This is the Senate bill. And that's what we talked about last time is, you know, the really only option is you do something really close to what the Senate did, because the second you start trying to screw around, you lose Democrats and you can't do this without Democrats. So, you know, this was a longer, more tortured process than it probably needed to be. But maybe it wasn't. Like, maybe you did have to go through all of this. I mean, it was only 2 months ago that the Senate, which is a long time, but only 2 months ago that the Senate passed theirs. I know this request has been sitting out for months, but it was mostly the Senate sort of spinning their wheels on immigration forever that ate up most of the time. They had to get through funding the government. They had to get through FISA. I mean, this was the first real opportunity to, like, have this front and center. And he probably needed all of that time to kind of bring himself there, get everybody sort of conditioned that they wanted to do it. And of course, as we talked about, the strike from Iran on Israel probably didn't hurt the dynamics either.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that we didn't really talk about this last week, but, you know, the discharge petitions hanging out there as well. I mean, there was, you know, sort of an argument that was made, I think, correctly by Johnson. And maybe one of the reasons why we were feeling like something was going to be done here is because, you know, it felt like there would be momentum pushed towards a discharge petition or, you know, something done here if this didn't come together.
I'm surprised he actually didn't raise that, or they didn't, like, put the word out a little bit more on that as sort of excuse.
I heard him talk about it a little bit, but okay. I don't know that it got, I don't know, it wasn't front and center.
I think it's a very real possibility that if this failed again, that the dam would have broken on the discharge and we would have ended up in the same place. And so you'd never want that to happen. Is the leadership, you want to control what happens and don't allow your members to sign a discharge. So I'm surprised that, yeah, I'm glad they were then, because I haven't heard them spreading the word about that as a reason to do it, but I think it's a pretty credible reason to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to Johnson not having, you know, a ton of leadership surrogates pushing his message, but I heard him, you know, mention it a couple of times. But to go back to the immigration bill, because I think that there, like, to me, there is nothing that it's just stark relief the way that Republican hardliners are complaining about not being able to get things done with respect to immigration. And then you have this immigration bill, which, you know, as we know, HR2 is passed. It's not going to go anywhere. This is sort of the same. But you have this bill that's coming up. It's having to come up under suspension because the Rules Committee does not function. So, you know, imagine you're Johnson trying to get something like this passed, and, you know, you're going to have to rely on Democrats to pass anything. So you have absolutely no leverage walking into a conversation about trying to move a bill like this. It's like almost mind-bogglingly hypocritical.
Yeah, but it works for those guys. Like, they don't care. And that's ultimately where things keep breaking down, is they don't mind upsetting their colleagues, and they've upset their colleagues a lot. I mean, the Freedom Caucus, I mean. We saw a lot of public commentary this weekend using some pretty harsh language from members about their colleagues. But they're always able to frame themselves as the defenders of liberty and fighting for conservatism and all this stuff.
You don't have to deliver anything.
Yeah. Being against leadership always sells in conservative politics these days, no matter who the leader is. So, but yeah, like they are this, I mean, this ultimately, and we'll get to this, like this, okay, well, where are we now after this? Like the Johnson called the play, they did it, they got it done. They had to use a lot of Democrats. Is the conference actually pissed at Johnson, or is the conference actually pissed at the Freedom Caucus? Even just on the immigration vote, there were a lot of people upset that conservatives blocked being able to bring up the immigration bill under a rule. They had to do it on suspension, so it failed. Needed 2/3. Of course, that's not going to happen. And so while they're passing the Ukraine thing, they weren't able to at least get a messaging win for folks who are taking that somewhat tough vote. We'll find out, but my sense is there's a lot of people who are much more angry at the Freedom Caucus than there are at leadership right now.
Yeah, that's how it feels. I mean, it feels like rank and file are really frustrated. But, you know, a lot of those people wanted the foreign aid package to go through, so they were successful in getting their, you know, their policy win, which is what some of them, you know, probably care the most about.
He didn't get a majority of the majority, but I promise you there is a majority of that conference who is glad that that passed. A lot of people who vote have felt like they had to vote no, but we're glad that we are sending money to Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about what's next for Johnson. Control is a 7-letter word. And this podcast is a production of 7-Letter. 7-Letter is a leading strategic communications and bipartisan public affairs agency. Our work is powered by senior practitioners who develop and execute innovative communication solutions to take on complex challenges. Learn more at 7letter.com. Now, back to the program. You had a piece on Monday in the New York Times about the House conference, Johnson's leadership, and how the House is functionally governed, you know, by this coalition of Democrats and Republicans. And your kind of your main point is that these hardline Republicans have made themselves irrelevant.
Yeah, like I'm all in on this conversation that, you know, we've now got a coalition. However, I think that is a very unsustainable, unsteady coalition in the long term if Johnson doesn't act a very particular way. But yeah, I mean, the Freedom Caucus has, you know, I think as I talked about, has decided that their playbook is ask for something that they know is never going to happen with a 1 or 2 seat majority when Democrats control the House or the White House and the Senate. And then throw a temper tantrum and blow things up when they don't get it. And it gets really tiring after a while. But as a practical matter, what ends up happening is you always end up working with Democrats. And this isn't necessarily a new thing. And this is sort of my point. We worked Republicans and Democrats together on the debt limit, Republicans and Democrats together on funding the government. Obviously what happened here. But it's been going on like that for a while. And the upshot is, though you have a Republican majority, you end up having less conservative policy because you don't have a functional majority to push forward reasonable, realistic Republican priorities. You can pass Republican markers all day long, but when they are just so out of the realm of possible, they're not a negotiating position. They're not leverage. So HR2 is a great example. You're not actually adding yourself any leverage to the conversation with the Senate when you pass HR2. It's just so far beyond anything that is possible that you, and if that's your bottom line, that's the only thing you're willing to do for some people, then you're just going to be written off. And what's going to end up happening is you're going to have a policy outcome that makes no improvement. And, you know, look, we know that there could have been border provisions that would be huge wins for Republicans in any other context, but they're not willing to accept that. But that's just one example. Like the spending levels, the, you know, anything that you could get on a debt limit ends up becoming less conservative when you can't marshal a majority. And time again, we've not been able to do that. And so it's just sort of out in the open now. Like the governance of the House does not happen with those 30 or so people who are never, ever going to vote for anything. And Johnson seems to have awoken to that reality. I think the Freedom Caucus is quite aware that they are written out. Maybe they're cool with that. Maybe it works for their politics. I do worry, though, that that only works for so long as Johnson is taking that that bipartisan road. He did it on the government funding, did it here on Ukraine. But there are a lot of, you know, choices he's going to have to make about how he operates the rest of the year.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you think he does for the rest of the year? Do you think he kind of recognizes that he has to stop relying on Democrats to pass things? I mean, there's not a lot to pass for the rest of the year. There's not a lot of big policy. Like, there's a couple authorizations he needs to get done between now and the election. But, I mean, does he try to give a bunch of maybe messaging votes to some of the hardline Freedom Caucus members to try and get back in their good graces? I was kind of surprised that the push to change the motion to vacate on the Ukraine package or around that time. I mean, there were a lot of conversations, and it felt like Johnson was maybe going to do something to change that threshold. And I was kind of surprised that he didn't even pursue it.
Yeah, he should have tried, but I get why he didn't. Is the juice worth the squeeze there? Because to your original point, what is it that they have to do the rest of the year? He's definitely helped by the fact that there are really no other must-pass things. They have to reauthorize the FAA and the Farm Bill and a few things like that, but they can just punt on that, and those aren't particularly high stakes things for politically. But there are still a couple things that, look, McCarthy lost his job because Democrats didn't trust him. Right now, to an okay extent, Democrats trust Mike Johnson, and that's why they're saying they're going to support him. But two things to keep an eye on. One, funding levels for the rest of the year. They're about to start up the new appropriations process. The government funding deal that they enacted last month was set at the bipartisan McCarthy-Biden debt limit level. That was after lots of wasted time and effort in the House with Republicans pushing much lower spending levels. That agreement is still in place for what the spending levels should be for this coming year. Does Johnson stick to that deal, or does Johnson once again go down the road of, well, the House is going to pass much lower spending levels, abandon it? At that point, do Democrats say, well, here we go again, this is, you know, not somebody that we can really rely on to work with us? I don't know. And then the big one, of course, what does he do on Joe Biden and impeachment? Sounds like this is sort of going nowhere. But I'm still very much not convinced that Republicans won't try to make a push to impeach Biden. And if they do that, I don't know that you can really still count on Democrats to bail you out on things. So there is a path ahead for Johnson where he doesn't do a whole lot, governs in that what I would consider the realistic lane of what's achievable, what's doable, what that governing coalition can look like, and, you know, remain in good graces. And we can talk about the sustainability of, you know, keeping your majority based on Democrats voting for you. But I think that is the path ahead that can govern, can keep your job. But he's going to have a lot of pressure, to your point, from conservatives to do things to make them happy. And maybe messaging bills are fine, but there's going to be a lot of pressure to do deep spending cuts this appropriation season. There's going to be a lot of pressure to do heavy oversight stuff. And it's just a really delicate balance.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even feel like any of that stuff has to happen before, I mean, something bad happens. I don't know if it's...
Well, they have to do a CR, for sure, and everybody at the end of the fiscal year. I think they get that, I guess, but, you know...
Well, I guess what I mean is, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene was on Fox on Sunday saying, Mike Johnson's leadership is over. He needs to do the right thing and resign. If he doesn't do so, he will be vacated.
He has completely betrayed the Republican Party. He has completely betrayed Republican voters all over the country. And he is absolutely working for the Democrats, passing the Biden administration's agenda. So this is a speakership that is completely over with. It's only Mike Johnson is the one that's trying to hang on to it and is in complete denial.
So that was a couple of days ago. So, I mean, I think certainly he could try to do some of these spending cuts or, you know, try to give some red meat to Freedom Caucus. But I guess I'm just wondering if something doesn't shake before that. I don't know.
Well, it's very nice of her to invite him to resign. I don't think he's going to take her up on that. Look, she's talking a big game. Like, she has the ability to take him out. And I don't think she does right now. And I think if she...
You think she would have if she could
I think
have.
She would have. Yeah, I think she would have had the vote if she could have taken him out. I think she knows that in that moment, he was going to get bailed out. And when your most powerful tool against the speaker gets taken away from you, you look pretty weak and you don't really have any... Like, what does she say then? She could do it again in a week or two. But like, if they defeat her a few times... And that becomes sort of the pattern. They don't have a whole lot to, you know, use against him. If she has a plan, and I don't think she does, but if I were her and I had a plan, I would sit tight. I would, you know, criticize him, you know, however she's doing, but I wouldn't move until that goodwill with Democrats starts to fade.
Like once they start impeaching the president.
Or doing a lower spending deal, spending levels. Because, right now, Democrats, you know, very happy, waving the Ukraine flags, like they're going to stick up for him enough, Will, anyway. But I don't know if that's true in a month. Like what's going to happen in a month? I don't know.
I was trying to see what Democrats, like how they were posturing on this, because I'm, you know, not super close to those conversations. And I thought it was interesting. Ro Khanna said he deserves to keep his job till the end of this term. I mean, I thought, you know, I totally agree. I don't think that Johnson should bank on that. I absolutely don't think it's a guarantee. But I thought someone like Ro Khanna saying, you know, in no uncertain terms, like not like I'm going to bail him out in this instance where he's passing Ukraine, like he deserves to keep his job through the end of the term. I thought it was interesting.
But look, and I'm a progressive Democrat, and I think you would have a few progressive Democrats doing that. And I disagree with Speaker Johnson on many issues and have been very critical of him. But he did the right thing here, and he deserves to keep his job till the end of this term.
Well, next term is a whole other question about, because at that point you need like an affirmative vote for a speaker, and Democrats are not going to vote for Mike Johnson on the floor. That's different than a motion to remove him. And until something like that passes, he remains speaker. There is this conversation about what are Democrats going to ask for? What's going to be their concession to save him? And I don't know how many times I've said this. There is no concession. There is no like power sharing. The concession right now was bringing up the Ukraine aid. Like that's the deal. The governance is what you get out of it. But a month from now, 2 months from now, do they feel like you've done something for me lately and are still willing to do that? Because if this is insufficient 2 months from now for Democrats to feel like they owe Johnson something and they're kind of peeved at him about some other thing he's done since then, there's not a scenario where he cuts a deal with them, where he gives them something. That's just not how this works. Like then a ton of Republicans will be pissed off and come after him. This just needs to be how I govern responsibly, I govern the way I think it is. It can't be some like open or, you know, shady deal. Like that's just never going to happen. That's the same reason why you're never going to have this coalition speaker vote at the beginning of next year where like there's some power sharing. That's just not how this stuff works.
Okay, well, let's just talk about a hypothetical here. So let's say, for the sake of argument, that Marjorie Taylor Greene does decide to go forward with a motion to vacate. I think she has, you know, a handful. She has two other members who have said that they would support her at this point. You know, things could change. But let's talk a little bit about what options Democrats have available to them to help Johnson or to manage this motion to vacate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the options are somewhat limited, but I'm really curious as to like what would actually be best for Johnson. So I imagine if this comes up, there'll be a motion to table it, which is effectively defeating it, but at least it's not a vote directly on it. if you're Johnson,
so then the motion to vacate would not come up.
If they table it, it would go away, and like that, would, the debate would be over. Let's assume that's the vote. If you're Johnson, would you rather have? I'll put this to you. 215 Democrats vote with 215 Republicans, and you just blow it out of the water. Like, you know, maybe it's not that high, but like 400 and something to a very small number, table it and defeat it. And it's just like the House has spoken on this. Or would you rather have let's say there's 10, I don't think there will be this many. Say there's 10 Republicans against him and they put up 15 votes to just barely save him. And everybody else is just coy and says, we'll give you as many votes as you need. But mm-hmm. like, it's not like a huge number. Or Democrats vote present. Democrats don't show up for the vote, which lowers the threshold. So you could still get to a situation where Johnson preserves his job on the strength of Republican votes, but it is because there's just a lower number there needed. Those are all the options. And maybe in the end, he survives all of them. But I just wonder, if you're him, would you rather have tons of Democrats and everybody, basically the House speaks, they throw you a very narrow lifeline, or they get gimmicky and just don't show up?
I think I'd rather have just a total rebuke and an overwhelming support from everyone in the House just saying, we're not going to be doing this.
That's where I am too. I think that is like the biggest statement, basically putting Marjorie Taylor Greene on an island and saying like, and look, if you're Johnson, like this is the best person you could ask for to do this. Like nobody wants to help Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republicans, Democrats, like nobody wants to be with her. The one thing I would guard against is you probably don't want a situation where more Democrats are voting to save you than Republicans are voting to save you, because then that just kind of feeds into it. Again, it's all sort of semantic at that point, and she's going to like rail against him no matter what. But I do think just a huge overwhelming vote taking out that threat is the best thing that could happen. But I don't know that's going to happen. I mean,
I think it depends a little bit too on the circumstances of the timing, and you know, there's we could feel differently based on kind of what that specific thing is that brings the Freedom Caucus to try and oust Johnson.
Yeah, and I think we underappreciate that there is politics at play and pressure for Democrats to not save the Republican speaker.
Especially as we get closer to the election.
Yeah, like I don't think they're going to make it super easy for him. I mean, we can pretend that, you know, they've got, you know, all of the noble interests, but like, no, they're trying to fight back and take back the House. Like, they're going to do what they think is best for them, you know, in addition to the governance piece.
I think the overwhelming rebuke is what would have happened if she tried to move a motion to vacate while they were debating the foreign aid packages.
Yeah. And so the question is there like a slow bleed where they no longer feel like they owe him anything, and Green's positions, you know, as a result, get stronger? I think he survives this Congress. I really do. I don't think he's going to resign, but I couldn't like promise you that for sure. And you know, you've already seen the Trump folks and a lot of Republicans, even Freedom Caucus members, like this is not the time for us to have another disaster on the floor. Look, if you're a conservative and you're mad that you're not getting the policy you want, the solution, as should be very clear right now, is not changing the speaker. Like that's not going to change your fortunes. What could change your fortune is you win more seats, you win elections, you take the Senate, you win the White House.
You replace members of the Rules Committee.
That too. You have more than a two-seat, one-seat majority. Like that's the kind of stuff that you should be thinking about if you want to have policy change. And I don't think you improve your position in the election by having another floor debacle, changing leadership in the summer before the election. Now, Marjorie Taylor Greene probably doesn't care about that. She probably wants to do whatever is good for her.
Get her more television.
Get her having another 100 reporters standing outside her on the Capitol. Like they love this stuff. They love it. But that pressure will exist in the conference. Like, don't do this now. This is, you know, bad.
Yeah. Well, the House is out this week, so not a lot that she can
he
do.
He won't be
this
removed
week.
This week.
but of course, the Senate will be in passing the foreign aid package, and then we can't let you go without talking a little bit about Mayorkas' impeachment trial.
Please tell us what happened in the Senate.
Yeah, it was not a lot of fanfare. I did see that they marched over the impeachment. I don't know
they
if you
did,
saw that. Johnson was not there.
They did the very dramatic march. Is the speaker usually there?
I don't know.
Did he not sign the engrossment of the...
I'm sure he had to sign it. Yeah. I'm not sure if he typically walks with the
managers
over
there.
He wasn't
an impeachment manager, so I doubt he would go over there.
Okay. They did their walk.
Yeah. It was a close one, but the secretary survived that. I guess the open question now, is this the only impeachment we have this Congress? There was a lot of energy for lots of impeachments, but that did not go very well for Republicans. So.
Well, now that they've gotten through most of their policymaking, maybe that's
they've
what
got some time on their hands.
They'll turn to. So you'll have to listen next week to find out.
Yep. All right. Well, we'll be back next week, regularly scheduled. The House will be in session. But glad we were able to get together and recap what happened over the weekend. It was, I do think, probably one of the most consequential votes weekends of this Congress. So didn't want to get by without talking about that. But we will see you next week.
Control is a production of Seven Letter, a leading strategic communications firm in Washington, D.C. and Boston, with deep experience in bipartisan public affairs, public relations, crisis management, digital strategy, and corporate engagement.
Special thanks to our producer, Benji Englander. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Please join us next week for another episode, and don't forget to rate and review us. Thank you for listening.